May 31st, 2016. You're looking live at Charleston, South Carolina. This is episode 564 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and thank you for spending part of your day with me. I hope you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. I'm out on Folly Beach in Charleston, South Carolina with my family. Mostly just getting excited about watching the Copa America and then looking at the beach and wondering why people like the beach. Stay indoors, watch movies, watch sports, read, sun. Anyway, that was a more flippant introduction to this podcast than I would otherwise necessarily like to make, because I am very excited today to have as my guest Ezra Edelman. He is the director of the epic, fantastic, mind-blowing 7.5-hour ESPN documentary OJ Made in America. I wrote about the film for New York Magazine. I will also be writing about it later on for Sports on Earth. I might even write every day when the show airs. The show will air, starts airing on Saturday, June 11th on simulcast on both ABC and ESPN. That's part one of the 5 episodes of the show. You can see that night, and then they will switch over to ESPN for the second 4 episodes. It is unbelievable. This is one of the best documentaries I have ever seen. It is 7.5 hours, and at the end of it, you're like, I can't believe this is over so quickly. It is addictive and fantastic and wonderful, and I was elated to get to talk to Ezra. I just think the movie is fantastic, and I think that, frankly, in about 10 years, it will seem hilarious that Ezra Edelman would have ever lowered himself to talk to me on my podcast. So make sure to follow Ezra Edelman on Twitter at Ezra Edelman, EZRAEDELMAN. Make sure to watch episode 1 of OJ Made in America on June 11th on the ABC and ESPN. If you get a chance, if you're in New York or Los Angeles, you can actually go see it in a theater. I've not seen it in a theater. I watched it on a screener. But I recommend, if you have the opportunity, to see it in a theater because, A, it's uncensored. Not that, like, there's hardcore pornography in it. But, you know, there are wordy dirds and you know, some boobs. You know, the type of things you can't show on ABC and ESPN that I think are important to be seen. Not so much the boobs, but you know what I mean. You'll be seeing it in its purest form if you see it in a theater. But mostly, it's just a terrific film, and I'm honored to have on as my guest today. We did this in person. We talked when I was in New York City last. We sat down for about 45 minutes and discussed all sorts of different topics about the movie OJ Made in America. Make sure to please subscribe to us on iTunes if you don't already. Give us a nice review. It helps people find the podcast. The music is by the Sundog in this podcast. Here is Ezra Edelman. All right. First off, thank you for coming. I've been very open about my enjoyment of the film. And I just want to remind everyone, see it on June 11th on ESPN and ABC, and then get on ESPN the rest of the week. That's out of the way. If this is the first place you found out where to see it, I do not trust the listeners' research skills. I've talked to you about this a little bit before, but I'm curious about one of the things I find fascinating when I talk to you about this is that your interest in OJ was not strong, really, or this case anyway, right, or this whole phenomenon was really not strong before you started working on this film, right?
That's correct. I mean, I was not an OJ obsessive. I did not follow the trial, you know. Like you, I was in college at the time. But what I probably was more than most people who maybe even were obsessives, I was much more engaged by who OJ was before. I knew OJ's story, the sort of basic aspects of it. And so in that way, I had actually a good sense of sort of stuff 30 years earlier than more so, and that's what interested me more than anything that happened in 1995.
Because, you know, and that is one of the key things that we have a lot of things to get into. Mm-hmm. But to me, one of the many, many revelations of the film, and it's not so much a revelation as much as it is, you know, you were on with John Howland and I on the Culture Caucus podcast, and John brought up a great point about how he would actually love to see its own documentary on that moment where Jim Brown and Lew Alcindor and all these, and they go up to support Muhammad Ali. Yeah. And one of the fascinating things about that is, at that moment, O.J. Simpson is like, he makes an active choice. It feels like that was a moment of choice that I don't think, you know, a lot of people realize he had made.
That's correct. I mean, the amazing thing about, you know, that footage, but then there's sort of a famous and the pictures that go along with it. You sort of are looking at 12 right. prominent black athletes at the time, you know, first and
like
foremost.
Stars.
Stars. Yeah. And so, you know, yes, you have literally Lew Alcindor, Jim Brown, you know, Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell sitting down, and then they're flanked above them by Bobby Mitchell and, you know, sort of others that were like, these were the guys. And the notion that, especially that Lew Alcindor in 1967, who was at UCLA at the time, is sitting there, you know, puts a little bit more of the sort of the sense of like on you that, well, then he's in college.
Right. You can't just say OJ's a college kid. He doesn't have to take a stand on this yet, because you see someone at the other college
Correct.
Actually doing it.
And I mean, by the way, you can excuse this in the sense that literally OJ got to USC in the spring of 67. He was in school.
Right.
But, you know, this is where I am perhaps maybe more forgiving Right. of OJ than the others, where I think that that's a lot to put on anyone from a burden standpoint when you're trying to sort of navigate your way through the world and before he had actually played a down of football at USC. So whether it's, you know, right or fair to even suggest that he shouldn't have been there, but what it is very clear based on who OJ was in that year and became that year, that he almost seems notable in his absence.
Yeah. Like, and it's not like he kept making that choice.
Well, no, but that is the period that divergence
right.
sort of begins and where essentially regardless of whether he's at the Ali Summit or not, the same metaphor or the same point exists in the sense that here is this movement of black athletes. OJ is then, you know, 6 months later essentially asked to join it in the form of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And OJ is like, no, thank you. You know, famously saying, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And in real ways, like, I was very cognizant about sort of the divergent paths. And he really sort of forged this path that didn't exist.
Right.
There's no such thing as a black athlete who was doing commercials.
Right.
And so the question is, like, did he specifically have that ambition, or did someone say, you know, you can do this, like, you're at a place, and or you're around people, and we can make this happen for you? And so the question is, like, how calculated was it from the get-go, and how much he was seduced into taking that path?
And I think it speaks into a larger point of the movie in general, too, in that, you know, the idea that OJ was really being groomed for white audiences in a lot of ways is something that a white audience would not notice.
Like, well, you can speak to this more than I can, but the question is, like, right, you don't notice
right.
when things are done from a racial perspective right. if you're not sort of growing up thinking about race.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, too, there's a very powerful, the movie obviously goes through the history of race relations in Los Angeles and moves that way. And one, you know, it's funny because, you know, I wrote about this for New York Magazine. And one of the things for me, one of the things I liked about the movie so much is I think everyone's going to have their own reaction to it, and to a lot of different things, in it. And it's always hard to talk about the movie because I feel like no matter what, I can't do. I'm only talking about one section of it,
yeah.
And there's so many other parts of it. But certainly, you know, I think one thing that I had a strong takeaway from the movie is, you know, you remember what it was like. I wasn't obsessive of the case,
yeah.
I followed it so closely, and I wasn't like passionate, like, they better convict that guy. But certainly, you know, it was a fascinating case. There were a lot of things going on. I believed him to be guilty, and I believed he probably should be found guilty. But it wasn't like I was screaming in the streets about it.
Right.
Certainly, I was baffled why anyone on either side was, to be
right.
entirely honest
yeah.
with you. But I was also baffled that anyone would think he was innocent and why that would be
mm-hmm.
a good thing if you were found innocent. So, you know, for me, you know, that's been a progress of that. Your movie was not the first time I was like, hey, wait, this may have been a civil rights victory. But certainly, it makes a very strong case to that idea that this, you know, there's a line cut from my piece, basically, that we have space,
yeah.
just the idea saying that, like, you know, the general thesis of you do such a good job of showing all of the things that black people had to deal with in Los Angeles, and to see someone like OJ acquitted was obviously not going to balance the scales on that, but it's a start, and it's something in that realm, and I could not have understood that then. And I think it's interesting when we talk about OJ here and how he looks at different audiences and what people's different experiences. Ted Brazino, who's one of the four Rodney King
mm-hmm.
cops, is from my hometown in Manchester, Illinois. And not only is he from my hometown, but after he was found innocent, he left Los Angeles and moved back to Mattoon. He's still there. He works security in Mattoon. We all know him.
Okay.
And so that is an actual, literal, geographical thing that when he moved back, I was like, oh yeah, is that the guy that was in that? And now I'm like, oh, you went back to Mattoon because...
Wait, do you actually know him personally?
I mean, it's a small town.
Yeah.
Right? He's not like a family friend,
yeah.
but like, everybody knows him,
right.
you know, and certainly he's...
Yeah.
But like, so, and he, you know, he works security at like public events, so you see him. And certainly it was a news item when he
mm-hmm.
came back to town. And to me, that is an actual, like, that is a geographical difference of of how people, I think, saw the verdict, saw race relations, and frankly, in a lot of ways, will hopefully this will, because I think one of the other point I made in the piece was, every time I get on Twitter, it feels like a sad place where everyone's screaming at one another, and even at me sometimes over this piece, and I'm sure you, once the movie comes out,
I hope not.
As well. I'm sure Twitter will yeah. totally be cool. But one of the things I argue in the piece that I think is a positive thing now is in 1995, I can't bridge that gap.
Right.
Like, I can't bridge that gap. I'm a guy at a I'm a guy at a white school. I mean, University of Illinois, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, it's a small town. I'm 19 years old. And whereas now I have access to voices that I did not have access to before. Do you think that's something that will help your movie or hurt your movie, not so much hurt the movie, but her perception for the movie, is that, like, it feels like this is, like, I now have understanding of things that 20 years ago, like the movie itself, I couldn't have understood 20 years ago. Do you see that? I think you were in college at the same time, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you see a change in perception because the way we talk about this stuff now, because we've talked about the case? Do you see a different world, at least in the conversations that we're having?
I mean, it's funny. I'm someone who is, you know, has a Twitter handle. I don't tweet. I do. I am interested. Yeah, like I'm interested in the conversation. And so in that way, there is, you know, the ability and access to a conversation that previously wasn't able to be had. Having said that, I'm sure there's still a rarefied group of people who are having that conversation. And so, you know, highly educated and sort of interested and curious enough to engage. Now, I don't know that the people who would sort of say the negative things and want to shout out on Twitter are people who also would be receptive to actually listening and hearing other people's points. I do think there is an access to a conversation that wasn't able to be had 20 years ago. I think that's a great thing. But having said that, we've also seen with the way that the world's working, even with today's elections, there's just more outlets for shouting.
Yeah.
There's more outlets for expressing sort of, you know, potentially less than enlightened viewpoints. And that's sort of a concern, because it gives we all have more power. And we all have voices in a way that we can't. So, and you know, does it mean that, so on the one hand, I guess it's a blessing and a curse, because I can hear your different perspective in a way that I wouldn't have had access to hear it before. But I also could hear your perspective in a way I didn't have access to.
You can hear me screaming at you.
Correct. In a way that I'm like, and it's like, that's what you think? And I'm like, I don't really. And so in some ways.
I didn't even know that existed.
Yes.
Right.
And so now it's like, okay, so does that sort of foment some sort of agreement, connection, empathy, understanding? Or does that foment tension, frustration? I don't know.
I'm going to get to your background a little bit. You worked on, I think you're most well known before this, working on Magic and Bird and Ghosts of Flatbush. The one that I've not seen is your Requiem for the Big East movie. Yeah. I've not seen that, so I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But I'll get it. I mean,
you're from the Midwest. It's not for you.
Yeah.
Maybe now when I do it, you know, Creighton's in the big, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Do something on Creighton and Butler, and just do something on the 89 Flying Illini, and we're going to be fine. But the process of this getting made, you know, I know Connor Schell, I've known him, you know, I've known Closer, but I certainly know him as well. And it does feel like he is almost, like, he's, obviously, if you work in the business, you know Connor, you know how much he's had to do with 30 for 30. But in a lot of ways, he is almost like the quiet champion of this project.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, quiet maybe publicly, but not so quiet in the sense that, I mean, it was his idea.
Right.
And so in some ways, you know, it was not only his idea. So he did come to me and ask me to do this. He had the idea of doing something that was more ambitious from a link standpoint.
Specifically on this case.
On OJ.
Yeah,
and, you know, and so, like, no, he came and said, you know, and it was actually, the first thing he said is, we've done 90 or something films, and we want to sort of start doing some more ambitious projects, and we have this idea of doing a 5-hour movie. And I said, oh, that's really cool. What's it about? Oh, it's about OJ. And so that was less interesting to me, sort of based on what you already said. Having said that, the point being is that it was his concept to do a deep dive into this story even before he knew it could be done. It was also his sort of attention to it and belief in what we were doing that it allowed it to be now what it became, which is 7 hours and 44 minutes. And, like, he wasn't so hamstrung in as far as when it was going to air, how it was going to air, or what the budget was going to be. He figured a lot of stuff out to really fluidly engage the process as we were going on, and it made it very easy for me to sort of see it through.
Yeah, and it was funny because even, obviously the 30 to 30 project's been a big success, but, you know, I think there was a sense among some that, like, as good as the films are, you know every 30 to 30 is going to be good. There's no question. You know it's going to be good. After you make anything a lot of them, there's a certain sameness that can creep in. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, it was exciting for me to see that even before I had seen this project, that they recognized that. That we need to cast larger. Did you agree immediately to do that, or to do this project, or did you have to be talked into it, or was it really just a matter of once they told you, Ezra, you can do what you want, then let's sprint?
No,
what month and year is this?
This is the first conversation was February 2014. After the first conversation, the next day I went to LA, where I was going there independently for something for a week or so. I have a lot of friends out there, and I said, yeah, by the way, like, you know, they asked me if I was interested in doing a 5-hour thing about OJ. I don't really know that I want to revisit this topic. It's like, I lived through it. And a lot of people who are my friends know me and know the things I'm interested in. And they kind of like, no, but they were like, actually, this has to do, this actually has to do, this is kind of your wheelhouse. You're kind of built for this. If anyone's going to do this. And by the way, the weird thing is, if you pay attention to, once I got into it, if you pay attention to OJ and all this shit, like, there's been plenty of stuff that's been done. But there's still the feeling in my head, like, no, this hadn't really been done. No one had really sort of gone into it. And, you know, fact is, we learned very quickly, even as we started doing it, that there were other people doing things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But, like, it was somewhere between I was initially reluctant. I don't know that I was talked into it, but it took a couple conversations. But the thing that was the most convincing was the actual canvas, the size of the canvas, because that allowed me to explore topics and the history of the context of the story in a way that hadn't been done before. And that's what I was interested in. The one thing I wasn't was, let's figure out what happened on June 12th, 1994.
Yeah,
I don't give a fuck.
And that's, and you know, that clearly comes through in the movie, but, you know, also one of the things that I find most impressed about the movie too is it engages all these larger themes and puts everything in a larger context. But also, like, you know, there's stuff in this that feels like scripts. Like, there's stuff in this that, like, you have footage in this movie that is, as someone that's been paying close attention to this case and has read Tubin's book and has followed all of this for a long time, I was still like, I can't believe he has that. Like, the Al Cowlings talking at Nicole's memorial service, OJ talking after at his yelling at the television after his party, after his celebration party, which to me was astounding. And frankly, the very first shot of the movie, the very first shot of the movie is OJ now, and I think
it's a parole hearing,
and
a couple years ago.
I'm curious when, as you came along, because I understand that you might not have had a lot of interest specifically in the case, but there's a lot of stuff in this movie. Did you that came from someone who got into this case? like clearly, like, while you're engaging in this larger
By the way,
once you're in,
the question is, like, how are you getting it done? And the fact is, the really hard part about it is, great, so you're giving us all this time. Well, now we have to fill the time. Right. And so the fact is, you know that you are both at the same time doing something. You're doing a film on a story that has been picked over more than any story in our culture in the last, you know, half century. And so what is there left to tell? What is there left to uncover? But yet you know that for it to have, basically to make any sort of impact as a document, you still have to offer things, perspectives, characters, interviews, and footage that does feel real, or feel
right,
new,
right,
or is new. Right. And so, but what you don't know is, what are those things? How am I fine? Because when you start, you have no idea.
Is there a momentum with something like this once it gets going? Because, you know, forgetting all the time you have to fill.
Yeah.
Once this thing gets started, you have to, you know, you have to convince people to talk to you. You have to convince people that you're doing this differently. Yeah. Then is there a couple humps you have to get over, and then everyone's like, oh, okay, he gets it. Like, they're doing this the right way? Or is that a project conversation you have to have every single time?
You have to do it a lot more. Yeah. So there's genres. Like, you sort of have to, like, it's like, with this more than other, I mean, genres of people, groups of people. And so that you like, where you're like, oh, but that you have to convince that you're doing this a different way. There is momentum that is built upon people who know each other. And so how they talk or how you, so like, I spent a lot of time and there's a lot of angst trying to get Gil Garcetti to sit for an interview. And by the way, I didn't even get in contact with him until, you know, 4 months after I'd even started doing interviews. And so that was like through a connection of a family friend, and I ran him an email and he says, I'm not doing an interview, but you can come and talk to me. And that was begat, yeah, I'm still not doing this, fine, and two more conversations. But it wasn't until he finally said yes. And once he said yes, then we could go to Bill Hodgman, who's the deputy DA, and say, by the way, Gil's doing this. So will you, okay, you can meet me. And so like that's sort of, there's some way the process gets easier.
Even someone like Marcia Clark, like now, I think because she's like writing for Vulture and doing all of these things, I think there's this notion that Marcia Clark is like this really easy person to get, but she wasn't at all.
Marcia was impossible. And Marcia had not talked about this for basically 20 years, or since she wrote her book and did press for her book 18 years ago. And so, yes, she'd never done this. And so, yes, it's a little, like, I love Marcia and the fact that she participated and she's great in the movie. You know, but she also got up after the end of the interview and she was like, well, this was great. This is the last interview I'm doing.
Didn't turn out that way.
You know, but hey, by the way, I can't blame her because, look, I don't know what it's like to have your life portrayed to the world, you know, on TV by a character. And, you know, and with all due respect to Marcia and to her credit, like, she's had her moment, you know, with the FX show and Sarah Paulson's portrayal of her, and she deserves it. And so if she decided, by the way, and she's a living, working author, and she should be out there promoting herself.
Well, and too, because I think, you know, I think one of the ways that we look at, not only are we more aware of some things about race, and we're some more aware of some more things about gender now. There are things that were done to her during that trial that I think now there would be a lot more outcry about than I think then. Was there someone that you, because I always remember, like Lancito famously has like never talked at all after this. Was there someone you really wanted to get and didn't and weren't able to land?
I mean, a lot of people. I mean, I would have loved to have talked to Lancito. He wasn't at the top of my list. I mean, I would have, first and foremost, I would have loved to have talked to Marguerite, OJ's first wife, who we never even found. You know, obviously, like, I would have loved to have talked to Al Cowings, but he's never done an interview. So it's like there are certain people you just sort of like,
you know, you're not going
to get. We had a board, and I mean, it doesn't mean anything talking in a microphone to people listening, but like we're in a room where
he's looking at a make board.
So it's like we had boards that were basically the length of two of these walls, back next to each other, where we had cards, index cards, broken down by chronology and or genre of the story and or OJ's life, color coded. Names with certain dots of, you know, yes, no, maybe, who's been in contact, who hasn't. And then there was literally a list of people that said the untouchables, you know, and it was like, OJ, you know. So there's a sense of like, oh, if I could get one of those or I get two of those, then we have done incredible. And like, I don't even know if we got any of them. But so that gets back to that threshold. What is the threshold you have to satisfy to make this seem real, intimate, in a way that is different than what has been done before? And you hope that you cross that threshold in some form. I think we did, even if we didn't get OJ's family. But, you know, I understood that OJ's, they don't talk.
And I think another thing that gets lost to people, I think, when they watch it is, you know, this is, not only was it not like this lifelong passion project of yours, that I think there's clear passion in the film that comes across, it was put together pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, you said February 2004 is
really, 2014.
14, I'm sorry,
2014. Well, right, but I would say in earnest was about this time 2 years ago, where it was probably May where I started working on it. I mean, we didn't have a deal until Memorial Day 2 years ago.
Okay.
So
deal was for the five hours.
That was for the 5 hours, okay. And it was like, and so in some ways, I officially started after Memorial Day 2 years ago, and I spent that summer basically just reading.
Right.
Without doing anything, because I think for me, philosophically, the way I do anything, it's like, get the foundation of what this is all about, where do I want to go with this, what is this, where are the connections I'm trying to make, before I pick up a phone to talk to anybody.
And you've got a team of how many people?
We initially started off, I hired, you know, Caroline Waterlow, who is our producer I'd worked with before. She was the first person that sort of came on board and was going to work with me, and then we went out and hired Tamara Rosenberg and Nina Kristic, who are two other producers, and Tamara was primarily responsible for outreach to characters, and Nina was our archival producer. And again, immediately I got the sense of like how overwhelming this was, from the sense of I'm used to really controlling everything, and there wasn't that possibility. And the fact is, between especially Tamara and Nina, not to mention Caroline, who does everything, but then when we got to the point of hiring our editors, and we had three editors, all of these people were so independently talented and passionate themselves and proactive. There was not the time or bandwidth from anyone's perspective to be able to say, by the way, Ezra, I'm going to do this. What do you think about this? Or I'm going to call this person. It's like, I didn't know Joe Bell existed before Tamara called me and said, I just had a conversation with this dude. And it was like, and so for me, that was one of those things where you realized, before you've ever worked with anyone, like there's, you know, it's hard to gain trust. In terms of, are you good at what you do? What are you bringing to the table that I can't, or that and as soon as like these things start happening, you're going like, oh, okay, we got the right team together.
Is there, so the process then, when do you sit down? What's the time between you sit down to start editing? First of all, what's the last piece of footage that you got in the movie? Like, what's the last thing that you got?
And it was just constant. Yeah.
How close until you were close in his first screenings? And the last piece.
Honestly, probably that week.
Yeah.
I mean, we literally are filling scenes out.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't speak to exactly. I mean, for instance, Jim Brown might have been the last person I interviewed.
Okay.
And so the scene of him, and he's in sort of one scene in the movie in the first half hour, but even the sort of footage surrounding. So, you know, we already actually had the footage of the Ali Summit. That was already going to be in the film regardless. But then filling out what he was saying. Through that, like, no, that was a very, and so that's where someone like, again, Nina, it's like, we're doing, it's like, the editor's working, and I'm overseeing these three things, and it's like, we're trying to, we need to get this, and this, and this, and this shit just shows up,
yeah,
and it's like,
the plane in the air.
Yeah, but that speaks to also, when you're doing this, even when you're starting this, you know, how many people you know you have to interview, but there is no ability to outline this and say these are all the people that are going to be interviewed. It's like it's a catch as catch can thing, and things do build upon themselves, and so you know that constantly there is a board in our edit room where there are names written down where I'm still hoping to interview these people as I'm going forward. And so it was never this thing, it never felt complete until Monday when we finished.
Does it still, are there, have you been able to walk away?
We're done. We're done as of Monday. Have I been able to walk away? No. But like, but as of Monday, I made my last creative decision, which all had to do with our music. Our composer, Gary Leonelli,
it's possible the version I saw, I watched it.
Yeah, you didn't watch the finished version. Right. You actually probably didn't even watch close to the finished version.
Yeah, sure.
And I like to think that, Gary did an incredible job with the amount of music, and you know it's sort of heavy on music. It's, you know, it feels more unified with a score that sort of, you know, has themes that sort of exist throughout.
So I want to get back to this notion, particularly of OJ personally as a sort of a civil rights icon. There's a fascinating stuff after the verdict is over, and the fourth episode is really the trial, I think it's a thing that really kind of key on to people that, like, there's really only one episode that deals all that closely.
The second half of the third episode is about the trial. Right. And the first 20 minutes of the fifth episode is the verdict.
Right. But like, it's not, the trial is not a major part of it. But one of the things that's fascinating to me is after OJ is acquitted, and he becomes this sort of awkward civil rights icon. He shows up at black churches. He's on a very awkward Wendy Williams radio segment on there. And I think it's fascinating to see how he, you know, that he feels, you know, OJ himself is such a need to be the popular person,
yes,
need to be
correct.
That guy, and to watch him turn that in now a new direction with a new set of people it's clearly like something he's not comfortable with, because it's a turn in a lot of ways.
Well, except that I'll sort of say I look at it like an addict needing his fix, and so it's sort of like I'm used to getting this from this world that I've sort of ingratiated myself towards and become comfortable in, and now that world is rejecting me, and so where do I go to get my fix? And so what's the more powerful need? You know, it's not that like I can hang around other people, but what I just need the love.
Yeah.
Like I can't be, my existence can't be sustained without that love. And if you're not going to offer me that love, I'm going to go to a different place. And that's what I saw with him. Now, having said that, this gets back to the whole notion of what goes on in OJ internally throughout the entire film and throughout his life in terms of who you are, where you come from, and when you further divorce yourself from that person, what happens to you. And so I can't speak to truly that, you know, internally. You know, that's the thing about this film, no matter how long it is, if it was 20 hours long.
You're still not getting on set inside.
You can't explain the unexplainable. He's a uniquely complex guy.
And it is fascinating because you see him becoming almost more unmoored and more. And, you know, I remember the great Seth Meyers joke of after he was convicted, saying O.J. Simpson was convicted today of to 8 years in prison, however long, for robbery, but really murder. And, you know, and I think that was, I think, the way people saw it at the time. But I think the movie does a good job of kind of explaining what really went down with that and how it wasn't actually just some random incident. It was something that he'd kind of been building up to for a while.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is where, like, if either of us were therapists, we might be able to dissect what happened a little bit better because, you know, did he go into a hotel room in Las Vegas to steal back his own memorabilia or possessions because that's what he was doing and he's OJ and fuck you, like, you have my stuff, I'm going to get it, and I get away with anything, I'm not going to worry about it? Or is there a sense, as some people have said after watching it, they're like, yeah, I think that dude wanted to get caught.
Yeah, I mean, he's hanging out with idiots. I
mean, well, yeah, but that speaks to what we just said before.
Right.
Where do you go to get the love? And so if all of a sudden your world changes based on who accepts you and who still kisses your ass and who still allows you to be OJ, that's the unfortunate sort of
There's
place
not
you had to go.
Left.
Correct.
In that regard. When you're putting all of these interviews together, and you're personally on doing all the interviews.
I'm doing all the interviews. Yeah.
So, was there anyone that was more difficult? Was there anyone that did they get combative? Were there combative interviews? Was there anything along those lines, or did everyone kind of get pretty early on what you were trying to do?
There are some interviews that were more difficult. None of them were combative.
Okay.
It was more like, because I don't have a combative interview style. I have a, you know, I would do interviews sort of like we're sitting here right now.
I
write a lot of questions down that I don't look at, and so it's very conversational. Having said that, there are some people that you know you have to get certain things out of, and there's certain people that are that it's trickier. I mean, Mark Furman was a tricky person to interview because I don't really know who this guy is. I don't really know where he's coming from. I don't really know how he is in 2015 and how he looks at me, you know, as a person of color and as a, you know, it's like, oh, from what you hear about Mark Furman, I'm black and I'm Jewish. That doesn't seem to be the guy that he wants to hang out with. But there's nothing about the way Mark presented himself in person to me that made me think that he was that guy in the way that he was portrayed. And I didn't think I was being snowed. And so you're trying to work out sort of, and what's also my job when I'm doing this interview? My job is to really have him as openly and honestly detail the experiences that he went through. My job isn't to determine if he's a racist.
Right.
You know,
and I think that it speaks to another larger thing the movie does, which is that everybody gets a hearing.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone, you know, not only is everyone getting a hearing, but, you know, one of the things that you and I talked about on the Culture Caucus podcast was the idea that these are characters in the story. They are built up to be. There is a character that shows up in the first episode. I hesitate to call them episodes because I still think of it as one piece.
Right.
But I know people will be watching it
as
five episodes. That they pay off for 3 hours later, and like they're you know then maybe they're not explained, maybe you don't see who they are, but they pay off later on. And I feel like there's a fair hearing for everyone involved that I think it's going to help the movie. Everyone have their own experience from it. Like, there's not a lot of times where you watch this movie and you're like, oh, well, I disagree with that. And, you know, which to me is a general public documentaries across the board.
Right.
It's not all documentaries, but the whole, for more information, go to this website in the closing credits.
Like,
activist documentaries that I think are, I tend to agree with the message and I tend to be on their side. There's just still a certain distance of, are you trying to tell a story or are you trying to
advocate for a cause?
Yes.
I wasn't advocating for a cause.
And I think the film clearly comes across that way.
And I think it was important for me, considering, like, you're talking about his story that, you know, the meat of it and sort of the end of it was, like, we're talking about something that was incredibly divisive.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, if someone can, if all these perspectives can be if perspectives can be shifted, if empathy can be gained throughout, you know, through watching this, because all of a sudden I'm going to hear cops talk about their job in a different way, or I'm going to hear black people talk about sort of what happened living in this city over the course of these 30 years to let you understand why people were so invested in this trial or why someone celebrated them. Like, that's the whole point, is to let people who aren't of a certain perspective hear people's perspective, and maybe they'll be swayed. And the other thing is, like, you can't reduce any of this stuff to some sort of, like, here's the conclusion. It's messy. And the only way to sort of convey that is to embrace the messiness and the complexity. And so in some form, that's what I was trying to do. And the, I think in some way, the thing that I've been most surprised by, but pleasantly surprised by and happy with, is that, oh yeah, you can do something that is long, that is based in history, that doesn't sort of take a clear side and doesn't have a clear conclusion at the end, and it's still engaging to people. And I mean, like, I'm like, oh, that's nice from a storytelling perspective, because you, nothing ever gets wrapped up in some neat bow. And I knew I couldn't do this because, by the way, you're talking about someone who, you go down the street and you ask to say something, what do you think of OJ? Everyone has something fucking different. And like, you know, and like, I'm not doing this film for one person or for the other person. I'm doing it for everybody.
You know, and obviously part of that is having that kind of a canvas and having that long to do. Like, I you know, I we were talking earlier about the movie Wiener, about Anthony Wiener, and I talked to Barbara Morgan, who was in the movie, and she said the hardest part for her watching the movie, she thought it was a good movie, but the hardest part was knowing how many other things that were going on that they, and she, and that they just cut down to a 30-second segment, so on. And that, and she's like, but I'll say the movie's an hour and a half. Like, what are they going to do? They can't tell the whole story. And so to me, the ambition of this is not so much, I'm going to try to tell this story of OJ or this story of OJ, but that actually thing that you're talking about, the idea that I'm actually going to be, just get every single possible angle on this that you can see from every possible perspective. And it's so rare to see that, that I feel like either you should make every movie or every movie should be 8 hours. Because I say that like kind of jokingly, but it does feel, particularly now, like, listen, just in our general culture, the idea that people have time for anything, let alone, and I think we see in our political conversation right now that the just sort of drive by and talk about something, you know, I used to always, write about sports, I used to always talk about, when I would actually criticize ESPN, one of the things that was frustrating to me was ESPN had sports fans.
Yep.
And so therefore, to grow the audience, what you needed to do was to get people that were only just casually paying
attention. Yep.
And to just be as dumb as possible. And I think that they've gone away from that in some ways, and I think there are other media organizations that have doubled down on that a little bit, we'll say. But, you know, to me that was, I feel like so much of our culture is like that. It's for people that are only casually paying attention.
Correct.
And so one of the things I find exciting about this is it is for people, like, this is a movie you pay attention to. This is a movie that, and the kind of the magic, I think, of what you've done is you've kept it watchable all of that time. Because, like, there is, I think you've done a lot of these interviews, and I'm sure one of the most common dumbass questions you get is, man, so why does it have to be so long? Why? And to me, like, that is, the fact that that is the first thing that people come to is worrisome and frustrating to me.
Well, no, but here's the thing. I mean, the thing is, I don't need to be the person who does it every movie, and every movie doesn't need to be 8 hours long. I think that the fact is, someone asked me actually about the fact that if they thought this film, and sort of having been given this canvas, they're like, you must have a lot of filmmakers coming to you and being like, oh my God, that must have been incredible. Like, how do I get into this, like, you know, long form documentary game sort of thing? And my response was a little bit like, yeah, no, because why would anyone want to do that? That wasn't fun, first of all. Second of all,
it's fun,
like,
now, it's over.
It's, yeah, it's fine. But the second thing is that, like, I don't believe every story befits that treatment. And so the fact is, I would have been, like, I advocate wholeheartedly for more long-form documentary treatments, even if it's more from a, like, Ken Burnsian approach, who I think is phenomenal and great. But, you know, when he does films, they are actually more classically episodic, even within how he does the films.
Right.
They are sometimes anecdotally, like, things placed next to each other that probably have an overarching structure, but they're not telling one story.
You get done with one story, you go to the next.
You go to the next story. Right. And so that's sort of what makes this different a little bit. But I think to your point of, like, you have to be pretty humble about what you're trying to do as you're doing it, when you're doing something this long. And so what that means to me is that, like, it just means that the distance you're trying to travel is longer. But I use this once maybe, but, like, to me, the metaphor, as I started thinking about it, it's like you're laying track, like train tracks. And the problem is, if this is a train to Topeka, Kansas, and you know that there's track that needs to be laid somewhere in Missouri or in Kentucky as you're going there, like, you need to make sure that track is the same as everything else, because you're just traveling. And, like, so if you get to the point where, by the way, and it's like, yeah, the jurors won't talk to me, or the prosecution won't talk to me, the train just stops. And so it's like, I'm trying to still get to that same place, but I don't have the, like, then your attention as a viewer, like, oh no, what you've already been doing, you no longer are doing this at the same level of specificity or intimacy that you did for the previous 3 or 4 hours, so I'm not as interested in the next 3 hours after that. And so that's the burden of, how do you keep that going with the specificity? Because you're basically, what you're kind of doing is five movies. It has to be as specific and as engaging as 1.5-hour treatment, but you're doing it over the course of 7 hours and 45 minutes.
And yeah, that's why, like I said earlier, like, it's weird for me to think of this as, like, an episode two, because it doesn't feel like an episode two or an episode.
And it wasn't. And it wasn't built that way.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel that way. And so that's how they show it on television. But, like, I'm envious because I've not got to watch it in a theater. I had to watch a screener because I'm in at this. I watched it all straight.
Right.
But, like, to have that kind of immersive sit down, watch it straight like that is an experience I would have liked to have had.
And I mean, and look, I think it's a little frustrating for me. Like, obviously, everything about this is geared toward it airing on ABC and ESPN, and that's great. But yeah, but that's also going to air with commercials,
right,
and that's going to air with some sort of, you know, standards and practices, right, you know, sort of things that have to be fulfilled as far as language that can't be used. And so for me, as the person who put this together, who put it together as one movie, the purest form to watch this movie is straight through. Now, I don't expect, because it's a lot to ask people to sit in a theater, go to the theater and watch it for 7.5 hours, or watch it in one sitting, because we all engage things different. We all have different attention spans. But having said that, it's built in a certain way, it should be absorbed in as pure a way as possible. That's all I'll say.
Okay, so a couple more things. Yeah. Are you? And this is a fundamental thing. I ask this for filmmakers make movies. I like a lot all the time. I think it's even more relevant here because of the vast massive of the projects. Are you ready for people to watch this? Do you feel like, are you ready to hand this? Like, this is now. They always say that, you know, filmmakers' intentions are one thing, but what the audience actually owns it.
Yeah.
This is a now about to stop being the thing that you made, and people like me, like, this is very thoughtful, well done, good work. It's about to be out of our hands now. It's about to be released to the world. Are you prepared for that? Are you ready to take a more, you've not really been that public of a guy, you say you don't tweet very much, are you ready for a more public-facing sort of, like, this is now about to be the world, and it's about to be your thing, and everyone's going to see it?
No. In some form, based on how this has been rolled out already, that it played at Sundance, at Tribeca, at Hot Docs, there have been people who have gotten screeners and watched it, like yourself. You know, I've at least sort of gotten that initial sort of understanding of how people are reacting to it, and, you know, people to this point have been positive, and that's been great, and that's been helpful, and made me been able to sleep a little bit better at night. I don't know that I'm as concerned or as sort of, like, it's like I can't anticipate something that I can't anticipate. I don't know how the public's going to react to it, and I don't know if, you know, I'm cognizant enough of the fact that, intellectually, I'm prepared for the fact that, A, it's very long, so people might not want to watch because of that. B, it's very long after, you know, and it's airing after a 10-hour series about sort of the same subject, so I can understand that people might not have room for two things. I might understand, by the way, this isn't for everybody, even if I want the desire. And the fact is, it's a story that, you know, triggers very passionate responses. And so while I want everyone to overwhelmingly respond positively to it, I'm much more intellectually prepared for people's reactions than I am emotionally prepared. And as far as me goes, like, yeah, no. Like, I mean, like, I'm not a very public person, but and...
We're not going to see you as a talking head.
No, that is not me. And I am, you know, I am more than happy to engage in conversations with people publicly about the film, you know, who are interested in it. Like, that's, to me, like, both a burden but also a real benefit, because I think that for me the humbling thing is we did work really hard on this film, and so that people have responded to it in a way that deems it worthwhile is sort of, that's the best thing for me. Like, that's the response, and or that's the result that I would crave more than any sort of thing. It's like, oh, we did something that people are paying attention to, and that's all you could ask for as a filmmaker.
And then the last question is, you know, I like to, this is a fun thing to ask someone who just finished a massive project and is about to unleash the world. If this is as big of a success as I think people are hoping you are, then do you get to do your passion project? Like, do you want to keep doing docs? Do you want to maybe start doing, do you want to do features? Like, what do you want to do? Like, what do you want to do? Like, if you get a, like, if this goes huge now and you get a blank check, like, what do you want to do?
I'll take the check and cash it. No, I mean, I honestly, right
okay,
now,
fine.
No,
not a plate check.
No, right, but right now, I don't know,
right,
is the answer, and it's sort of like, where do you go after you make a 7-hour and 45-minute film? I don't know. I mean, right now, this has been, you know, when you even talked about the time frame of it, this has been, when it comes to my work, I'm passionate, I'm pretty obsessive, but we did a lot of work in a very short amount of time. And the fact that even as we're talking here, can I say what date it? I mean, whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, it's May 19th right now. I finished this film literally on May 16th, like the beginning of this week. Like, and now I'm in this sort of place where it's great, but, you know, I'm talking about the film, and it's sort of like, I'm trying to put this down first.
Yeah, right.
And actually have some distance and actually rest before I can sort of go forth to the next thing. And what I can say is that, yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'll explore doing different things, but that could be in many different ways. I truly just don't know yet.
Well, it is, I think you know very well, but I think the film, it's a great film, and I honestly, like, when I think of what I want out of, not just movies, but, like, actual public conversation, it actually represents it very well. And that's why I made the joke almost about all movies being 8 hours. I don't think all movies be 8 hours, but they need to have this kind of perspective where every time you see someone on screen, there's no, that's a bad person, that's a good person, there is a generous spirit to the movie that I think comes across very well.
Well, I very much appreciate that. I appreciate you sort of everything you've written about the film. And the one thing I'd say to that end, if we are able to, with this film, provoke thought when it comes to who we all are, you know, versus how we reduce people to be, then I think we did something okay.
If there's just get one person to do it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I feel it doesn't. But seriously, thank you for your time. I appreciate everyone. Go, obviously, go see the movie. And thank you, Ezra.
Thank you, Will.